You be seated. The court is ready to hear arguments from relator and In re Ernst & Young.
May it please the court, Ms. Marie Gates is the argument for the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes to rebut.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, on this mandamus proceeding, we believe that mandamus will lie and that we meet the standard for mandamus under a trilogy of decisions from this court following Martin v. Lofton. The trilogy that I referred to is the Dillard case, Dillard Department Stores v. Hall, Texaco v. Sanderson, and Kmart v. Sanderson, all of which involved overbroad discovery requests where the court held that mandamus would lie and that there was no adequate remedy by appeal and no abuse of discretion because the request on its face was overbroad as a matter of law.
Let me ask you a preliminary question. Right now, this court is vacant. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And if the governor if we get this opinion out while it's still vacant, that's fine. But if the governor appoints somebody before we got it out, then we need to abate this case for that judge to take another look.
Under your rule, Your Honor, Traffic Rule 7.2B, right. It would be appropriate at that point because then there would be a successor judge.
So we're
judge.
Sort of in the race with the governor's office at the moment.
Right. Exactly. Now, why is the request overbroad? It's overbroad for the same reasons it was in.
Excuse me. You're not saying it's overly burdensome. Burdensome is not an issue.
Not in the sense, Justice O'Neill, of burdensome of trouble, expense in getting the documents. We have the documents. They're in our general counsel's office.
Okay, so they're there and they're discreet and they're public record as well.
Right, but the request is still overbroad in terms of being overbroad and not limited sufficiently in time, place, and subject matter so that it's reasonably calculated to lead to admissible or relevant evidence. That's the overbreadth that's at the basis of this trilogy of your cases that we rely
on. Ask another preliminary question. I can't over here.
I'm sorry, Judge.
Two things. Just to clarify what documents we're talking about, it's petition and complaints. And does that mean basically any state court petition, whether amended or supplemental, or any federal complaint, amended, supplemental, that's got a file mark that's within the time period? Not all documents in any lawsuit, but only those ones that we know in Texas as original petitions and in federal courts or complaints.
Well, that's, of course, this is a nationwide request.
Right, but I'm talking about it's not the whole litigation file public document, it's the beginning document.
Right, Judge Smith, the actual wording of the request is complaints and pleadings. Pleadings, and we have been talking about that in terms of petitions and complaints, but it does say pleadings. I assume that they would concede that they mean the type of documents and pleadings that you're talking about.
Second question about you submitted these two boxes of sample documents.
Yes, sir.
Not to say any bad thing, but I want to know how those documents. Were they selected in a lottery fashion, in random selection, or are they represent the most irrelevant lawsuits out there? Or
no,
how was those? What do those two boxes represent?
There were in two boxes because there were two sets given to Judge Lopez. One involved documents that were responsive to a request in a lawsuit that's going on between co-defendant Sindon and Ernst & Young in New Jersey. And one had documents in it that were responsive to the request here, but were not provided in New Jersey.
So the New Jersey, that one box is everything from New Jersey? Or is that a sample?
I'm not sure it was one box, Your Honor, but that's the two groupings.
Okay.
And I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's important to recognize that we did that, and it's true that we were trying to demonstrate how broad and overbroad and irrelevant some of the documents would be, but we didn't have to do that. This mandamus stands or falls on the overbreadth on the face of the petition. Excuse me, the face of the request, which is the point that Justice Heck made in his separate opinion in Lofton versus Martin. It's overbroad as a matter of law on the face of the request.
You're not making any claim that it's a wrap. I mean, some of these cases have gone off on the fact that it's a million documents.
Right.
And merely the burden of gathering and producing it cannot possibly outweigh the benefit that may be down in the bottom of that haystack.
Right.
You're not making that type of
Not in the sense of cost or expense or trouble to
so
get it together.
So it's purely that it's an overbroad request and
right,
beyond
but
the bounds of discovery.
We still say it's harassing in the sense that it goes beyond relevant discovery and that it goes beyond discovery that would be appropriately limited by
but
time and place and subject
matter.
But
not in terms of the fact that you're going to have to shut down your normal audit business.
That's right. That's right. Yes, sir. We've conceded that.
But now, before we leave that, so you're saying that the random sample, I mean, I don't mean that. To keep going on, but those boxes are random.
Right.
Okay.
Your Honor, what is the request? And I think that's important because we're arguing it's overbroad on its face. The request, which was put to us by our co-defendant, is for all pleadings and complaints for audit that allege audit malpractice anywhere in the United States. So it's any auditor for Ernst & Young anywhere, not the particular auditors involved here, for 7 years. And so it's also a long time period. Now, why?
Let me just ask one more question, then maybe I'll shut up.
That's right.
But we're not saying harassing or, not in the classic sense. This is not harassment and undue burden. This is merely, your argument is clearly outside the rules of permissible discovery.
Right, because now, it's not calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence because it's not sufficiently limited so as to be reasonably calculated to do so.
Now, how does that, without more, entitle you to a mandamus extraordinary remedy under the standards we've been trying to grope towards for the last decade or so?
Okay, well, first of all, Your Honor, we think if you look at the trilogy of cases that we rely on, that the argument there is precisely this argument.
So they're saying the fact that it's a million documents is just a make-weight. That's just a throwaway that you put into some of these cases.
Right. And once we give over the documents, of course, we've done, we are denied the relief we're seeking because...
But where would any overbroad discovery then be entitled to mandamus relief?
It would have to be a clear abuse of discretion. So I would argue that it has to be so overbroad as to constitute a clear abuse of discretion. I have a request that I feel like is overbroad with respect to every one of the three guideposts that the court provides in this trilogy of cases. It's overbroad on subject matter, it's overbroad on time, and it's overbroad on place because it's nationwide.
You say that it's overbroad because it won't lead to admissible evidence. Is it critical to your argument that we have to look at this in the context of U.S. Supreme Court guidance on punitive damages?
In Campbell. Campbell versus State Farm.
Which is what you provided. Your argument to get to your answer, do we not necessarily have to say that if it's a complaint that's even identical to the one that's made here, as long as it was a complaint that was filed in Arkansas, it's overbroad because that would not be admissible on the issue they claim it to be admissible, punitive damages? Correct?
Okay, Your Honor, we did provide the Campbell case because we feel like it demonstrates the wisdom of this court's jurisprudence limiting requests like this that go to gross negligence. And I wanted to get into that because the cases that I'm relying on are cases involving gross negligence contentions.
That's central to your position that the out-of-state documents would not be admissible. It wouldn't lead to admissible evidence.
It is helpful to our position. I would hope that this court, even if Campbell had not been decided in terms of the constitutional constraints of due process, that this court would still believe that under its own case law, under this case law that I cite that you all wrote, you would still think it was overbroad to allow nationwide.
But in order to find that overbreadth, we'd have to buy your assumption that we can only look for relevance to what happened by this auditor in this office before this malpractice occurred.
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. And I wanted to go over with you the overbreadth on all three guideposts, subject matter and time, and your question really goes to all of it. The reason that they say they want the documents, and Mr. Duggan told Judge Lopez, it's because of gross negligence. And, of course, the Sanderson case and the Kmart case involve gross negligence contentions.
But let's put gross negligence aside.
Right.
Let's just look at pattern or practice.
Right.
I can see easily a scenario, and I think they quoted one of the deponents in the case, who made some reference to another case that he was not involved in, the premise being that Ernst & Young follows generally accepted accounting principles.
Right.
Well, why is this not relevant to rebut that?
Right. Well, it may depend on what the subject matter of the accounting malpractice was in that case. You see, in other words, the subject matter here that they cite in their request is all auditing malpractice.
So
there's a lot of different forms of auditing malpractice.
Well, but so then if it may depend on that, don't they need it to determine whether it does depend on that? I mean, you're asking them to take you at your word that it doesn't depend on that.
Because I'm asking this court to hold that they have to be bound by their petition, just like you held in Sanderson versus Texaco, where you said if the gross negligence complaint goes to safety, they don't get all documents related to safety so they can figure out if there's a pattern or practice. That's exactly what they wanted to do in the Texaco case, Your Honor. They wanted to establish a corporate culture of disregard for safety. And this court wrote, no, I'm going to go look at the petition. I'm going to look at the exact type of harm alleged in terms of safety. In that case, it was exposure to benzene.
Okay,
and I'm
going
to limit their document request to that type of harm.
Tell me how you think a proper request should be worded if they
I'm
want
glad
to go
you asked.
Be
With
honest.
Respect to subject matter, we would go to the allegations of their petition, and we would say, okay, what type of account, auditing malpractice is alleged in this petition? It's alleged that the E&Y auditors in this case failed to detect and failed to disclose that revenues were inflated at CUC by manipulating reserves and other mechanisms. In other words, overinflation of revenues by reserves. That's one way to limit the type of auditing malpractice that is the type that is asserted in this petition. And you could say, okay, under Texaco versus Sanderson, we're going to hold them to their petition. We're going to go look at what's alleged. And we're going to say that the it's overbroad as to subject matter unless it relates to the risk and the harm and the misconduct that's asserted in the petition. But you see, if you say all accounting malpractice, then that's the universe. That's like saying all safety records in the Texaco case. And there are other limitations as well with respect to time. For example, they've got a 7-year time frame here. They go
Let's
back
talk about
from
that.
94 Let's all the way to 2001.
Let's yes. talk about the time frame because it seems to me that a lawsuit could be filed as late as 2001 over acts that occurred in 1977 or 1976.
Right.
So why is 2001 so far out of bounds?
Because of why they want it. They want it for gross negligence in order to demonstrate that E&Y was on notice of this pattern.
I'm saying that the lawsuit, the gross negligence in another case may have actually been alleged to have occurred in 96 or 97. The lawsuit might not be filed until 2001.
Well, Your Honor, one way to do a limitation here would be to say that if the lawsuit alleges within the relevant time frame, as opposed to being filed. And what's what I was getting to is what is the relevant time frame? They've got a 7-year time frame here starting in 94, but the audit in question here was 94 to early 96. It was completed in April of 96, and then the transaction that they're suing on was later, by August of 96, it was closed. And see, they're claiming they relied on the audit to be induced into the transaction. So why would misconduct asserted in other lawsuits that arose after the transaction was completed or after the audit was completed help them prove a pattern or practice or help them prove that they were induced into this transaction? That's for underlying liability.
So if it were limited to claims for gross negligence or for related in any way to overstatement of earnings for any time period before the underlying allegations occurred up through 1997, would you object to that?
For the underlying liability, we feel like it would have to be alleged misconduct that occurred before, at least before they entered into the transaction, and we would argue before the audit was completed. But
so you don't think that some type of fraud is committed a day after their alleged violation wouldn't be some reflection on the possibility that they defrauded somebody the day before?
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to repeat it, Judge Smith.
Well, it just seems to me, I can understand when you stretch out 5 or 6 years, maybe that's getting a little, it's somewhat attenuated, but to say that there's a bright line that whatever happens the day after you're defrauded is irrelevant to whether or not what happened to you did happen. I didn't say that correctly, but.
Well, Your Honor, if you don't have to accept the bright line to say that 7 years is too broad. 7 years for other acts was held by this court to be too broad in Kmart, and 5 years was held for other acts to be too broad in the Dillard case.
Because that was so overly burdensome and harassing. There is some synergy between
no,
those terms.
No, Your Honor, it's not. See, that's what I want to make sure I get across. It is not, those cases don't necessarily turn on the expense and the trouble. And when we say we've given up our burdensome, we're saying we can't stand here and say it's going to be so costly and so much trouble for us because we have the documents. But those cases are turn on the over breadth of the request in terms of the relevance of the request.
But
and it still would not be relevant, even if it doesn't cost me a lot of money to turn it over.
Ms. Yates, let's say we wanted to reconsider that. What is the harm in limiting mandamus relief to circumstances where there is a real monetary burden or manpower or something like that, because otherwise you're not claiming privilege. The remedy here, any harm can be addressed during the trial on appeal. there would be an adequate remedy to apply to. So why shouldn't we adjust our jurisprudence in that respect?
Well, I think that would be a change in jurisprudence.
Well, why shouldn't we consider that?
Because you're then permitting a fishing expedition of all sorts.
What's the harm? What's the harm?
The other harm to me is that you are allowing the other side then to propose and get away with getting discovery that's not within our rules because it's not drafted in a way that's reasonably calculated to lead to discoverable or admissible evidence because it's not sufficiently limited in time, place, and subject matter, which is the law. That's your jurisprudence.
Yeah, but there are a lot of times you can make objections, but if it doesn't matter to a client or to you, you'll answer, you know, whatever the discovery is because it's really not relevant. So I'm just trying to see underlying that, you know, we've got rules and I agree that we have to apply them, but aside from that, in terms of mandamus relief, this extraordinary remedy, right. Why should we take that extra step here?
Right. Well, I would say to you...
We have, I know, but why should we continue?
Right. That mandamus, of course, turns on clear error of law, and if the discovery rules do not permit the request as drafted, then it's a clear error of law. And as far as no adequate remedy by appeal, we are certainly being required to do something that we will never be remedied for, because once we turn over the documents, they're turned over. And to say that it's not harmful to allow the plaintiffs to go in this kind of fishing expedition and go try to find out every bad deed that Ernst & Young has ever done, to say that that's not harmful to fishing, I think that blinks reality in terms of how litigation really works. Because they're going to go take that and then they're going to concoct some gross negligence program, and then you do get to Campbell, a nationwide gross negligence. Maybe, you know, if the court's prepared to, I would say, throw over the trilogy that we rely on, then I think you do need to look at the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Campbell and ask whether or not you're allowing discovery of irrelevant information when you allow a nationwide search, because that's precisely what Campbell is prohibiting on a constitutional basis. And that's what they want the documents for. That's what they want it for, is gross negligence for punitive damages.
I asked you something before, you have to sit down about the place. I think that's important. I mean, this audit was done out of Connecticut.
Stanford, Connecticut office.
And there's a few partners there that were basically the key partners involved in this.
Right, and that's the limitation that we would suggest, either as a subject matter limitation or a location limitation. Instead of saying any audits for anywhere in the United States by any Ernst & Young auditors, how about limiting it to the auditors who were in charge of this audit? And that would get them the complaints or the lawsuits that Justice Cohen referred to.
But their argument is basically that there's a company culture, or a more definitive, a company manual or internal interpretations that these partners knew about but blew off. And is that condoned? I assume there's a hierarchy at the firm where there's some people who are considered in charge of the whole thing nationwide.
Right.
Then is this a culture that was allowed to exist? How do you find that out unless you look at the whole, you know, the accounting practice nationwide to see if this is a company culture like...
And you'd be looking at that culture, Judge Smith, for purposes of gross negligence and punitive damages,
right?
And that's where I think we really need to focus on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Campbell, which says that there are constitutional concerns with assessing punitive damages because I'm a bad company that has a nationwide practice of doing bad things. And that's where I think Judge Enix...
The way I would parse that is to say the limitation is punitive damages that reflect on how Texas is. You know, if you did something in Connecticut that would deserve punitive damages and it hurt somebody in Texas, I think we can look at it. I mean, I'll have to look at it, but that's how I would bring it.
That might allow you to look at activities out of Stanford, Connecticut, or to look at activities related to this audit, but it certainly would not permit a nationwide fishing expedition, which is what this request encompasses.
Do you think the pleadings in the Arrowchem case are a fishing expedition?
The Arrowchem case, Your Honor, settled, and in fact, those pleadings were provided to the co-defendant in New Jersey,
litigation. The briefing says
assuming you would be satisfied that the subject matter of the alleged audit malpractice.
I'm not talking about me satisfied. Do you agree that those pleadings are not a fishing expedition and are producing?
I agree that they do go to the auditors in question, which is one of the elements. But then I would say you have to look at the subject matter of the alleged malpractice, the audit malpractice there. And are you going to go with the notion that all audit malpractice is the same subject matter? And if it's not, then you have to look at what's alleged there. And if you allow them to say, well, I'm alleging a violation of the generally accepted auditing standards.
Well, who has to look at what's alleged there?
The court has to look at what's alleged there. That's what you did in Texaco versus Sanderson. That's what you did in Kmart, and that's what you did in Dillard.
Are you saying in camera?
No. You look at the face of their petition, and you compare the face of the petition. What is the allegation that's alleged?
With what?
In terms of whether the subject matter of the request is overbroad. In fact, in Texaco, there's wonderful language where the court wrote that the plaintiff is entitled to no more than the documents that relate to the specific type of harm that he's alleging in the petition, limited by time, relevant time, and relevant place.
But again, let me just ask you, do you think that the pleadings in that case are permissible?
No, not from what we've seen. It's not in our record, and it's not in your boxes that we gave you, although I understand it was, I'm told it
but
was produced
agree
in New Jersey.
Relevant.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You would agree they're relevant?
Relevant? Well, not necessarily, because if the type of auditing malpractice alleged is not similar in type, and that's
so even if this person, Wilchbert, was the person who committed auditing malpractice in that case,
right?
But it's a different type of malpractice,
right?
You'd say it's not producible.
It may not be,
and you're the only one who can look at the pleading and make the determination.
Well, Your Honor, can I give you an example? No, the court looks at it.
Then it would have to be in camera because you're not producing.
No. Oh, you're talking about the Arrowsmith
yes.
pleading itself. Yes, I see
so
your
you're
point.
Asking us to rely on your word that it's not similar.
No, I mean, I assume if the request, what I'm asking you to do is to look at the request on its face and compare it to their petition in order to, their petition in this case, underlying petition, in order to determine overbreadth. That's what I'm asking you to do. And can I say, with respect to your similarity question that you're asking now, that's in Campbell, too. Campbell says that a first-party bad faith claim is too different from a third-party bad faith claim. So if you had an insurance adjuster in Campbell, the same insurance adjuster, and he did bad things on a third-party claim and bad things on a first-party claim, under the Campbell opinion, the first-party claim is constitutionally irrelevant with assessing punitive damages because the Supreme Court 6-3 says it has to be so similar when you're assessing punitive damages, and third-party claims and first-party claims are not.
I'm just confused on how we assess similarity without seeing the pleadings.
Well, if you determine that you redefine the request in a certain way, and then Ernst & Young looks at its documents and it says which ones, it's the same way you would do any other production. We would withhold certain documents and say we don't think they meet the requirement. And if there was some question, I assume we could let the judge look at it in camera and see if he thinks we're wrong. Would we describe them on a log or whatever?
So if they pled 10 different means of auditing malpractice, then every complaint that had those same different means of auditing malpractice would be producible.
Your Honor, there could be 10 different meetings of safety concerns in Texaco versus Sanderson. You say there could be 10 different ways that the Texaco refinery violated safety rules.
I guess what I'm saying is if they said you violated GAP
right.
by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
right.
then you'd have to produce all pleadings where they alleged GAP was violated by 1, 2, 3,
well,
4, 5.
Well, I'm here to argue to you that we think that that is too broad a way to state the subject matter limitation. Because if you do it, that's what I was saying a minute ago, if you do it based on, well, we violated generally accepted auditing standards.
No, I'm saying they specify how.
Well, but Your Honor, look at those auditing standards. They're very broad. They're like the standards that govern lawyers. You know, you will be independent from your client. That's the kind of thing. It's very broad. And so that's why we're saying you ought to look at their petition and look at what's the type of auditing malpractice that's alleged to have happened here. Just like in Texaco, you looked at what's the type of safety risk that was alleged to be a problem in the case. And here, it's inflation of revenue by manipulating reserves. Compare it to the complaint that the plaintiff attaches to his brief to this court. Remember the complaint from the Federal District Court in Chicago that where the plaintiff proudly tells you, this is the kind of thing I want to use, this is what I want. And in that case, different Ernst & Young auditors in Chicago audited a bank and missed or failed to reveal that the bank had overvalued its assets. Is the overvaluing of the assets in the bank the same or similar subject matter? It's accounting, auditing malpractice. Is that the same or similar to what happened here? I mean, particularly when you look at Campbell, when you have the Supreme Court of the United States saying first-party claims are too different from third-party claims, for purposes of gross negligence, that's the key, is to recognize that that's why they say they want the documents, is to get to punitive damages.
Any other questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
May it please the court, Mr. Ralph Duggins and Mr. Gregory Shimon will present argument for the real party in interest. Mr. Ralph Duggins will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court, hearing with me today on behalf of real parties in interest, Cendant, and its subsidiary, Fiside, is Debbie Alsop. Your Honors, I submit to you that E&Y is steering this court down a slippery slope by urging this court to substitute its judgment based upon a very small sliver of a 4.5-year history for the judgment of the trial judge who has lived through that entire 4.5-year history. And as the court confirmed in Lofton, a difference in judgment does not amount to an abuse of discretion. And this case does not, contrary to what E&Y just told you, turn on clear error of law. As the Chief Justice pointed out, to get mandamus, a party must demonstrate that they will lose forever a substantial right. And there has been no showing in this case on that threshold.
Mr. Duggins.
Yes, sir.
I understand from the briefing that, is it Thiessy or Faisai?
Faisai.
Faisai does not have any claims against EY in this proceeding that we're here about. It has claims against EY UK, but not against the EY that's in this proceeding. Is that correct?
Sendent has a cross-claim against Ernst & Young's London affiliate that is pending, but I don't think the fact that there is no direct claim against the U.S. Ernst & Young makes any difference because Rule 192.3 says you can obtain discovery of any matter as long as it relates to the claims or defenses of you or any other party. It's very express on that.
But we are here about Thiessy's document request.
Well, it's both the plaintiffs have the identical request.
Which one was ruled on at the trial court?
The court was aware that the plaintiffs had the request because they participated in the argument. But the May 7th order that's in question, is a grant of the FISAI, or it's an overruling of the Ernst & Young objections made in response to the FISAI request.
Were these documents requested in the class action in New Jersey that I understand was settled or any other lawsuit that the other parties have against you?
I am not participating in the giant New Jersey class action, so I'm not told. I can't really speak with great conviction on it. I am not aware that this Arrowkin pleading, for example, has been produced. I've certainly not seen it. I do know that there was a request that the federal judge granted a similar request for pleadings in the New Jersey court. I do not know what the request was. I do not know what the objections were that were made by E&Y to that request.
The plaintiffs in the underlying suit, are they suing your company for punitive damages?
Absolutely.
And so to the extent, would this discovery be relevant to basically you pushing off your punitive damages on to Ernst & Young and saying it's their fault that this all happened?
Well, it's not just punitive damages that this discovery relates to. It's the defenses of the auditor here, which I'll come to in just a minute. But there's no question that Mr. Shamoon's clients are suing about 25 different defendants on a wide array of claims and defenses that relate to the issuance of CUC's financial statements that were filed with the SEC in 1995 and 1996 and to Ernst & Young's audits of those financial statements. And in late 1998, after CUC and HFS had merged, it was announced that those prior CUC financial statements were materially incorrect and not prepared in accordance with GAAP. It turned out in excess of $500 million in income had been misreported. And so, and E&Y said those financial statements were reliable and were prepared in accordance with GAAP. So this
regards
is...
Remedy.
I'm sorry.
Regards remedy.
Yes, sir.
If the request were for complaints that had been made against Ernst & Young for sexual improprieties between auditors or Ernst & Young personnel and their clients, and the evidence was it would only cost $100 to produce that, you don't think there would be mandamus relief in that case?
Not under the Walker versus Packer. And particularly whereas in this case, Ernst & Young voluntarily waived overbreadth, burden, time scope.
What is, since you can't get them back, and the case is never going to be reversed on appeal on that basis, what is the appellate remedy? You don't want to produce them because you don't think they're any that the other party's business. They're not even suing about that. And So you're never going to get them back. Get them back, they've already been shuttled. And the case can never be reversed on that because it's irrelevant to the case. What remedy would you have?
Well, I don't know if there is a remedy where the producing party did not object to the trial court that this is involves confidential personal information, that it involves that it would be burdensome, that it all of the various objections that I think were taken into account in this so-called trilogy of cases where all three parties raised overbreadth and burdensomeness, and the court seems to have weighed.
No court has any oversight over trial court to make them comply with our relevance rules. That's basically what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that I think part of the requirement to obtain relief in this court is that you must show a substantial right will be lost in this case.
If the trial court consciously disregards our relevant standards in the rules of civil procedure, who has authority to remedy that?
If a substantial right would be lost, which is not the case here, but I think arguably may be in your, Justice Heck, in your example, then maybe so. But all I'm saying is in this particular case where the pleadings are sitting in an office, there is no substantial right endangered by allowing the plaintiffs and FISA to pay ENY for a copy of those pleadings. Those are public documents.
Well, so are sexual harassment pleadings.
Sorry?
So are sexual harassment pleadings.
Well, I understand that, but as I say, I think there's a difference where a party asserts the proper objections to those, and I would agree.
Well, the only objection is you're in my general counsel's office. I know them. I've got them. It's only a foot high. It won't cost me very much to produce them, but I don't think I ought to have to produce them. Who's going to ride herd on the trial court and say at some point, you've got to follow our rules?
Well, I think that obviously this court can and has ridden herd on the trial courts. All I'm suggesting to you in my reading of Walker versus Packer is that this court emphasized that there must be a deprivation of a substantial right forever, the loss of a substantial right. And
well, but the question is really, and I think I understand it to be, let's assume the worst case scenario, that there is a trial court judge who just doesn't like our rules of procedure, thinks discovery ought to be anything that's conceivable, doesn't have to be tied to relevance or even the particular matters of this lawsuit, and just says you have you've got a right to roam through all of their corporate documents. As long as it doesn't cost that much for them to produce it, you're entitled to it. The rules be damned. And the issue is, how does somebody who is subject to that sort of abuse of discretion going to get relief? You're saying you can't get it by mandamus because Walker versus Packer doesn't allow it. You're also saying there's no real appellate remedy once those documents are produced, and there's no reversible error because all those documents are irrelevant. So who is going to tell that court you can't do that? You can't ignore the rules that way.
I don't know that I have a great answer to that circumstance. It's certainly not the circumstance here, but I guess the situation is that the party, where it's so far out of bounds, the party has an obligation to bring that to the trial court's attention, and I suppose in that circumstance, maybe you could argue some substantial right is lost. All I'm saying is that in producing audit malpractice pleadings filed against Ernst & Young during this limited time frame is not going to deprive ENY of a substantial right.
I mean, just explore this a little bit. If I don't know so much about the accounting business, but if it were a law firm and malpractice were alleged, what kind of discovery would the plaintiff be entitled to of complaints that have been made against the firm? All malpractice suits that have been filed, all complaints made against any of the lawyers?
My own view is that I think a trial court under appropriately pleaded facts would have the discretion to require that over a certain period of time. And in this case, there's been much made about the fact it's a nationwide search, but let's not forget that Ernst & Young does conduct audit services through a national office, through a single audit manual, in accordance with a single set of auditing standards. And all U.S. public companies who file financial statements must prepare them in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. So there is a known set of standards and limited set of standards applicable to the conduct here. And Ernst & Young provided these services from offices in London, Connecticut, California, Michigan, Tennessee, Florida. The transaction occurred in Texas. Mr. Shamoon alleges his clients were misled by E&Y in Texas. So there's a wide range of offices and people involved, some 75 auditors who were involved in just the 95 and 96 audits alone.
Why would you, assuming that you can get back to 94, why would you stop at 94? Why not go back?
Well, at the time, we thought that was a reasonable cutoff, Your Honor.
I'm just trying to find out why.
Well,
you're being merciful.
I'll tell you primarily because E&Y has objected to producing any work papers on this account, even though it's been in charge of this audit client since it took it public in 83. It has objected to producing any work papers prior to 94. So we have just used that as a cutoff rather than fight that and continue to fight objection after objection.
But you think you could go back?
I think you probably could because we have evidence, for example, in one of the depositions taken out in California that I took, that E&Y was aware of recurring errors that were material to the largest subsidiary as early as 1992. This order, this May 7th order, is limited in time. It is specific and definite. It identifies a class and type of documents, and they're public documents. It's not 30 years of pleadings. It's not E&Y's litigation files on suits. It doesn't include other types like sexual harassment claims or labor claims. And it's not a Lofton request, all evidence that supports your defense.
Is it limited to petitions and complaints?
It's limited to pleadings and complaints filed.
It's all pleadings in every case, not just the petitions.
Motions for summary judgment.
No, the words in the order. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I mean, is it just the original complaint, the original petition and complaint, or does it include summary judgment motions, final judgments?
We have always interpreted it this way when we've been in front of the trial court and had discussions to mean pleadings and complaints, the original petitions in state court action and an original complaint in a federal court action, not summary judgment motions at all. Never been any doubt about that. That's why I think they haven't compiled it in what they say they pull these together.
Well, the federal rules define what a pleading is. Our rules don't. That's why we're asking that question. So you don't want anything except complaints, amended complaints, supplemental complaints, pleadings, and state courts being petitions, amended petitions, answers, third-party petitions and answers, those types of things.
Your Honor, I would say, consistent with what I told the trial court each time it's come up, we want lawsuits filed against Ernst & Young in which it was sued for audit malpractice. And we did our best to word it when we said pleadings and complaints to try to pick up the state terminology and the federal terminology. Maybe we weren't as artful as we could have been in hindsight, but that's what we tried to do. I'd like to focus, if I could, for just a minute on the objections that E&Y withdrew. Even though the brief in this case leads off in the statement of the issues with reliance on overbreadth as the basis for relief, that specific objection was made and withdrawn months before the hearing, as was burdensomeness, as was vagueness, ambiguity, and seeking documents outside the time frame. Those objections were made and withdrawn. And I don't see how it can now come to court, or later can now come to court, and reassert those objections. At the hearing, E&Y offered nothing other than a token argument. Said, Judge, there's been lots of discovery. Enough's enough, which is not an objection. And two, this is a little bit of a witch hunt. There was no evidence offered. There was no comparison suggested, like you, I think, Justice O'Neill, were told in answer to your question, compare this with that.
Well, that's one of my questions is, you're saying there wasn't, so there wasn't any discussion or suggestions about how to trim this request up to make it within the rule, you know, was it, let's do it for Connecticut, let's do it for 4 years, let's do it, let's have a better definition of audit malpractice, a more narrow definition?
That was never requested or by the other side at all, if that's what you're asking, Your Honor.
But it was the response, you quote the response at page 19, Ian, of your brief, Ernst & Young objects because the documents are neither relevant nor reasonably calculated to lead to relevant answers. That was
an objection.
That was the objection.
Yes, sir. Justice Owen picked up on, I think, an important point. It's artificial for the relator to say a case filed in 2001 must involve acts in 2001. Most audit and malpractice suits are filed years after the financial statements are misstated and the audit malpractice occurred. The errors often go unreported by the company and by the auditor for years. And we do think that evidence of subsequent similar conduct is relevant to the plaintiff's punitive damages claim.
Wouldn't you agree that there be going to be some types of audit malpractice that are very dissimilar to this? I mean,
I don't know that I would necessarily agree with it, but I have not seen any pleadings other than what we read about. The best example is the one that's attached to the plaintiff's brief that was just filed late last year, in which E&Y is alleged to have committed the same types of wrongs that the Kevlins allege, specifically that it sacrificed the required independence and sound auditing judgment in favor of selling other services, the very claim made by Mr. Shamoon's clients.
They need a little time to argue, too, speaking.
Okay, well, I would just say, if I could, in closing, that if E&Y's position that it meets the Walker versus Packer test of the deprivation of a substantial right is met by the mere expenditure of effort, then this court will be rewriting that case, the Walker versus Packer opinion, and changing the law, because mere effort cannot equate to the loss of a substantial right.
I'll try to be as articulate as the lawyers that came before me. Last I was here, I was sworn in. Attached as an exhibit is a case against Mr. Wilchford that's filed by a plaintiff. Mr. Wilchford is a defendant in our case. And if we look at the tailored request of documents, we didn't ask and the judge didn't order accounting malpractice lawsuits, negligence lawsuits. They specifically tailored, and he specifically tailored the request to auditing malpractice. Now, justices, I am not clairvoyant. There is no way that a lawyer can mirror facts in another lawsuit filed against a defendant if they hadn't seen it. I'm not able to do that. And so I look at this case, and if you look at what Judge Lopez ordered, this case would not be responsive to the request. And I ask myself, can I gain any relevant information from this case that is not responsive to the request? And the answer is yes. And I point out one thing. In our lawsuit, we allege facts that Ernst & Young, when asked to participate in an investigation by CUC with regards to accounting malpractice, with regards to fraudulent conduct by some of its officers and directors, E&Y raised their hand and said, "We are not going to participate in this investigation if we don't have an agreement with you, CUC, and your lawyers that you will not render any decisions as it relates to our audit and our audit practice." And when you look at this case that's cited that's not responsive to Judge Lopez's request, we find a position statement in the opinion by Ernst & Young that says we have to give auditing work papers and auditing information to a previous owner of a corporation who had access to it at the time they owned it. Now, I know the bridge isn't really wide, and it may not be really long, But if I take their position statement in this case that's not responsive to Judge Lopez's request, I can find relevant information to use in my trial.
What?
That Ernst & Young took a position in this case as reported.
In another case.
In another case.
With other people or the same people? Or
with other people.
So it doesn't. So I don't understand that. You sue a lawyer for, I sue you for malpractice. I prove that your client, your one of your partners, one of your 800 partners screwed up one time, and now I've got evidence against you?
No. May I rephrase that?
Yeah.
No disrespect.
No, I'm trying to understand.
If you sue me for malpractice and you claim that I was not entitled to produce records to your partner, okay? And I say I am required to produce records to your partner, and that is not malpractice. Do you think my act of producing records to your partner in a previous issue or a previous lawsuit or a previous claim is not relevant to your case against me? I think it is. It shows an act, it shows conduct, it shows habit, it shows course of dealing, and it also shows my position on the issue. What we have here is we have a fraud cause of action, we have a conspiracy cause of action, we have an element which is intent. And when you look at the rule 404B, how is a plaintiff to prove intent? I cannot possibly get the Matlock confession by any of these defendants that are going to testify. I intended it to commit an illegal act. I have to do it circumstantially. I may have to do it by inference. And the law says that I am allowed other evidence to go to the issue of intent. And if I have prior lawsuits of auditing malpractice with similar conduct, I'm allowed to at least discover it. Whether it's inadmissible or not is not the test. It's whether I can gain and garnish some relevant information. I submit to you all, I'm able to do that. Just give me a chance to do it, and I'll do it. And if I can't do it, it won't be admissible in the trial court, and it won't be admissible in front of the jury. Last but not least, the issue of punitive damages. I'm entitled to know the net worth of a $10 billion company. They're private. I'm entitled to get their balance sheet, I hope. And in their balance sheet, there will be a categorical contingent liabilities. Well, what is contingent liabilities made up of? Lawsuits that are pending. Lawsuits that may not have settled. I'm entitled to go into the veracity of their number that they have put on their balance sheet on contingent liabilities. And the only way to do it is to have an access of what those contingent liabilities are. Otherwise, I won't be able to do it. That's all the time I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, if I could address first the waiver point. Justice Heck made the point that the objections that were made included objections that the request was irrelevant, was not calculated to lead to relevant, and also that it was a fishing expedition under Lofton. So if you went to Lofton, you would see the same type of overbreadth. But beyond that, on our motion to reconsider, which is tab 9, we laid out a whole paragraph on why the request was unbounded, how it wasn't limited by offices, how it wasn't limited to these particular auditors, that it wasn't tailored to similar claims. So it's just not true that we didn't preserve the complaint here. The waiver argument is a red herring.
Let me ask you a question.
To the argument that these are similar claims just because you label them.
Yes, let me ask you a question. If this were up here on an appeal.
Direct appeal.
After verdict.
Okay.
And let's say, I'm not going to do that analogy, but let's just say it's up here after verdict, and we hold that this was improper. We still have to do a harm analysis.
You still have to what, I'm sorry?
Do a harm analysis.
Mm-hmm.
How are you harmed?
Well, Your Honor, we're harmed because we've been made to produce documents and information that the rules do not require us to produce.
But would not obtain reversal under a traditional harm analysis because they're public records that are no burden to produce. So if you can't get to harm on a regular appeal, how can you get to extraordinary relief on mandamus?
Well, Your Honor, if we're being required to produce documents that we're not required to produce, it may not be calculated to cause reversal in the calculated to cause an improper judgment, okay? But on the mandamus standard, are we being denied a remedy that we can't get remedied by appeal. You see, you just posited the situation that I can't get it remedied by appeal.
But couldn't we carry that analogy to the trial court rules that it's going to admit a certain document, and it is clear error to admit that document, total error. Why, under your theory, could you not then bring it up on mandamus that he cannot admit the document?
In the middle of trial?
Sure.
Well, I mean,
under your theory,
okay,
but it's clear error.
All right, but I'm here following behind a body of jurisprudence that this court has already developed.
Presuming that on the admission of evidence, presuming the trial court goes off the deep end and admits something that is totally irrelevant, says I'm going to allow it in on Monday morning.
Right.
Under your analysis, that would be mandamusable.
Well, I'm not sure that that's the case. I'm not sure that that's the case.
Why is that any different? Because
because
it's error, it's mandamusable.
No, it's error for which I can't get an adequate remedy by appeal, and I'm denied a substantial right because he gets to go on a fishing expedition and I have to give him all kinds of documents that are not within the discovery rules, which then permits him to concoct whatever scheme he's going to come up with the punitive damages, a gross negligence pattern or plan.
But even if you can't get over harmless error, that's what I have trouble with. It's a public document. You've got it.
Right.
Right. It's hard for me.
I see your attempt to say that it opens Pandora's box, but I think it doesn't because this is limited to a discovery request where this court has already gone. You could just say we're not going to allow mandamus on admissibility rulings, but you've already said that mandamus is available.
But admissibility at trial would be worse. I mean, that would be more mandamusable if there's a clearly erroneous ruling on evidence to come in to the jury.
Well, I'm not sure that's right, but I see your point. I see your point. Could I just cover one other thing on similarity before I sit down, which is Justice Heck puts his finger on it on the analogy to legal malpractice. If you can come in on a legal malpractice claim and say, okay, I want every lawsuit that alleges legal malpractice, now here it's auditing malpractice, without any requirement of similarity, you see, then you have a request.
Let me explore that. One of the difficulties is this seems to me to be a range of issues, being broad or not too broad. But let's take the legal malpractice. Would it be sufficient if the request was limited to malpractice in the administration of estates?
It might be, Your Honor. It might
But couldn't you then argue, like you do in this case,
right,
well, there can be any number of things you could do in the administration of an estate, and so it's too broad because you're including administration of all administration of estate, and really it needs to be the administration of just generation-skipping trusts.
Justice,
and then couldn't you say, well, it can't
what
be.
What you're proposing is different ways to limit the subject matter. Maybe you limit it by saying only complaints against this auditor, this lawyer. Maybe you limit it by saying only this specialty. You know, auditors, like lawyers, specialize in different areas. They audit banks or they audit energy companies. Maybe you limit it like that. But to say that we can't figure out how to limit it and so we're not going to grant mandamus relief and we're not going to say this is overbroad, in all your cases before, you didn't tell the trial judge exactly how to limit it. You said we're granting mandamus relief because this request is too broad. It's too broad because it's not directed like the petition's allegations. And that's what we're asking for, is to require similarity on accounting or auditing malpractice what they're alleged here.
But on the determination of similarities, on the determination of how focused it be, don't we necessarily, in that overbroad context, have to look at what a burden it places? If you argue, well, this is so broad it's accounting malpractice. And they say, oh, no, it's limited to just auditing malpractice. And you say, well, auditing malpractice is so broad it ought to be limited to a particular auditing malpractice. And the argument goes on ad infinitum.
Right. And you can pick where on that spectrum, Judge Enoch, you want to stop and say.
Shouldn't then the court actually look and say, well, auditing malpractice may be more broad than it ought to be, but it's only going to require you to produce the complaints that's sitting on that desk that's a foot high, and the burden just isn't significant there, and we'll allow that to happen as opposed to all lawsuits that were filed over 20 years, and we can easily determine that's an overbroad deal, and we ought to limit it.
Well, we think that all lawsuits over 7 years is overbroad, Your Honor. But if you agree that it's overbroad in the sense that it's not narrowed by subject matter except to auditing malpractice, it's not narrowed to the particular accountants, it's not narrowed to the Stamford, Connecticut office, it's not narrowed in place or person or subject matter other than auditing malpractice, like legal malpractice, if that is overbroad, then it's not within the rules of procedure. It's not within the rules of procedure. And if it's not within the rules of procedure, that's a clear error of law. And then we can debate whether, you know, you think there's an adequate remedy by appeal if I have to turn over stuff that the rules don't require me to turn over so he can have a fishing expedition, which is what this is.
Let me ask you one last question. What responsibility, if any, does your clients have, obviously through their lawyer, in front of the district judge to stand up and say, look, this is too much. What are they going to do with a March 2001 lawsuit filed in Alaska against some partners who had never been to Connecticut, and regarding an audit about school attendance? That was one example.
Your Honor,
why didn't you stand up and say that? Let's limit this, and this is a good example, Judge, of why this thing's too broad.
Right. The hearing was based on the objection. Okay. The objection said that, in effect. That's my position. When it said it's irrelevant, it seeks... not calculated to lead to a discovery of relevant information. It's a fishing expedition under Lofgren, and I'll grant you that the hearing was brief. The hearing was brief on both sides. It's in this record. It's only a couple of pages on this topic, okay? But after the hearing, when the judge ruled against us, we filed a motion to clarify. We said, hey, wait a minute. This is unbounded, and we went through all those things you just said about how it needed to be limited. So, I would say if to the extent we had an obligation to do that, we did it.
It just seems tough to me to make a district judge an expert in accounting, you know, practice how big firms operate. You seem, you know, it's not common knowledge. So, I mean, to the extent you put it in front of the judge, I'll look at that.
Right. Well, Judge, I mean, I don't think it's requiring him to be an expert in accounting any more than Texaco and versus Sanderson. He had to be an expert in safety in a refiner. It's a question of looking at the plaintiff's petition and saying, hey, this alleges a specific type of auditing malpractice, not just plain auditing malpractice. And is what they're requesting limited to that same type?
Ms. Yates, real parties go on for pages about the alleged obstreperous conduct and refusal to comply with discovery for 2 years at the trial court. Is that material to our decision?
I'm sorry, Judge, you're going to have to, I can't hear you.
Real parties go on for pages in their briefing about the alleged obstreperous conduct involving discovery of EY and failure to comply with discovery on many occasions and frustration of the trial judge. Should that be material to our decision at all?
Your Honor, we didn't think it was, which is why we didn't spend pages in our response rebutting those allegations. We think we're here on mandamus concerning the judge's decision on this request, on our objection, and whether it is on its face as a matter of law overbroad as to subject matter, time, and place, and therefore subject to mandamus under this court's precedence. So, no, I don't think that's irrelevant. We don't agree with it. We don't think it's relevant. We don't agree with it. We don't believe we were obstreperous. And we think we had a perfect, legitimate right to object to this request.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments.